Welcome to the NABC Guardians of the Game podcast, where we go inside what makes a coach a coach. The Guardians of the Game podcast is a production of the National Association of Basketball Coaches and Learfield IMG College, brought to you by Wilson Sporting Goods. And now, here's your host, Dave Odom.
Welcome back to the NABC Guardians of the Game podcast. Today's guest is the head coach of the Loyola Ramblers, Porter Moser. Porter, thanks for joining us on the NABC Guardians of the Game podcast. I'm excited about talking to you for a number of reasons. I hope you're as excited about being on the podcast as we are as having you.
Absolutely, Coach. Great to be on, and thanks for having me.
Well, let's get right into it. Let's start talking about your early years as an athlete, not a coach. You grew up in the Chicagoland area, I guess we would call it, Naperville, Illinois. Today, you're early 50s. You've been a number of places. We want to talk about each one. You attended, is it Bennett Academy or Benet Academy? How do you say
Bennett
that?
Academy. You know, that was one of the things that started like my foundation of everything, because it was a program. It was a winning program. It was all about the team. We tons of, 13 or 14 straight conference championships. And it was all about winning at that program. And that's really started that foundation of, my recruiting philosophy now, of recruiting guys from programs and winning programs. And I just, all the guys that came out of that system, it was about the team. It was about development. And just had a tremendous amount of team success coming out of high school before I went to Creighton.
You had a coach, Bill Geis, that really kind of maneuvered that program along. Did you get close to him? Is he the first guy that, you kind of emulated as you've come along and you're a coach now? What do you remember about him? I know the record while you were there, 70 and 14 under Coach Geis, and you won several East Suburban Catholic Conference titles, and you were all-conference player a couple of times. What do you remember about Coach Geis that you might say, well, that influenced me to kind of get on that coaching railroad?
At that time, I didn't think I was going to be a coach. My father was the CEO of Moser Enterprises. My three older siblings ended up working for him, and I wasn't thinking – I was just like the normal high school kid. Everybody thinks they're going to be a pro. Everybody thinks they're going to be a great college player. So I wasn't thinking about coaching then. But what helped me and influenced me was I was just, he taught the fundamentals. He taught the intangibles. He taught the competitive spirit that the program did. And if you were in that program, it was all about the competitiveness, the togetherness, the culture, and that's what I took from that carried me over to Creighton, is that the fundamentals, the culture of being a part of a winning program. It wasn't until Creighton that I was with a couple of the coaches there, and then that reality of finally going, my career is going to be over after college, that I started thinking about coaching.
Well, let's talk about the Creighton experience. It was there that you played for one of our best friends, mine and yours, Tony Barone. Just as a backdrop to Tony and my friendship, Tony was a player at Duke. He was also an assistant coach at Duke, and they were going through some tough times at the time. And I was a high school coach, head coach over at Durham High School in Durham, North Carolina, which was about 3 miles from the Duke campus. And Tony and I would play tennis each and every day. And, he and I kind of knitted together as really close friends. And, that was back in the 60s. And, we just became, close friends for all those years. And obviously he passed away in the last year, and that was a heartbreak for all of us. But, from your standpoint, you were recruited to go to Creighton. He was the head coach. Tony was the head coach at the time, 1986 through 1990. You were at Creighton playing under Tony Barone. I think it's fair to say you weren't a star player, but you were one that Tony appreciated as being important to his team and his championship run that he made in the Missouri Valley. Talk to us about your experience at Creighton as a player, and then, you know, maybe you were casting an eye to Tony as being maybe a potential coach, much like he was.
Well, you softened the blow by saying I wasn't a soft player. You really had a great, nice, soft segue, because I wasn't. But I was. That's what was so special about Coach Broney, is that we had two star players, you know, Bob Harstad and Chad Gallagher. They were both like players of the year. But he really cultivated your roles and, you know, and made you feel like, you know, that there's pieces to a championship team. And, you know, when we got to Creighton, we were part of his first recruiting class. And, you know, what I take from that, we were dead last. And it's carried over to my whole career, because I've been a head coach at three different stops. And all three stops, the year I took over, they were last place the previous year. And when my recruiting, when we got to Creighton, they were last place. And by the time we left, we had won 20 games 3 years in a row. That's the first time that's ever happened at Creighton. And he just, he meant so much to me personally. And I will say this about this experience too, Coach, is I just got on a different tangent. I wrote a book for the first time. And I wrote a book, and it talks about my journey. And in the book, I reference Clemson football and John Gordon and what they talked about. Like John Gordon talks, they talk about a defining moment in your life. One of my defining moments that I talk about in my book was my freshman year at Creighton. And Coach Broney was involved with it. And I was at that crossroads where I was a star on the high school team. I've always been the best player on my team. And I get to Creighton, my first year right out of the gate, I'm not playing. And I really struggled at that time in my life. Like, all of a sudden, I thought, you know, I thought basketball was my identity, and next thing I know, I'm the 12th guy on the bench. And I almost quit. I almost transferred, and I almost, you know, just said, I can't do this. And I remember talking with Coach Broney. Coach Dick Fick was the assistant coach, was a big influence on me. And I remember being on that line, and I decided to stay and fight through the adversity. And it's not that it got better right away. I wasn't playing the beginning of my sophomore year, but it became a moment, Coach Broney, I'll never forget it. We just got slaughtered against Notre Dame, and he was all mad, and it was a mid-season conference game or non-conference game, and he said, we're going to go back to the defensive drills, loose ball drills, charge drills. Five guys who work the hardest are going to start. And I'm like, well, here's my chance. And I started that game and then the rest of my career. And I got the opportunity, and I look back, and then I went on to winning the conference tournament, playing in the NCAA tournament, making best friends for my life, getting into the coaching profession, and the whole domino continues. And I look back on that defining moment that a lot of athletes go through when they get there, don't play, they think sometimes the grass is greener on the other side right out of the gate. And that has helped me through adversity. Every time, you know, I face adversities, you know, I'm like, my first reaction isn't to quit or change, just because, you know, there might be better. It doesn't mean, because it's just because you change or leave or transfer or quit doesn't mean it's better on the other side. And Coach Broney was such a huge influence on me, sticking it through, perseverance. And you know him, tremendous energy with him. You know, one of those guys that when he walks in the room, the temperature, the energy goes up. And learned so much from about that. But my Creighton experience was, you know, to win it, the Missouri Valley Championship, to play in the NCAA tournament with the guys from where we started, has been a huge foundation of my career as we've moved on in the different stops.
You know, Porter, I'm glad you went into that description, because at some point in this podcast, I was going to mention to all of the young coaches that are listening, and we've got a good number. You know, it's easy to sit down and listen to some of the Power Five coaches, the coaches who are paid millions of dollars, who have private planes to fly around, and they recruit all over the country, and I can go on and on and on. But I think it's much more valuable for these young coaches to hear someone like you, who has You have been very successful, but you've had to earn it every step of the way. I mean, you know, you're at Creighton. You're not the best player. You had to work your way up. You learned how to go into recruiting meetings with Coach Peroni and the other coaches. You had to maybe mop the floor or get uniforms or get travel. All of these things that that go on at all levels, but mostly the coaches have to do them at the mid-major level. And that's where you've been pretty much your young career. And so I think this is maybe one of the more valuable podcasts that we're doing. So that said, let's continue on to talk about your upward mobility path. From Creighton, you went with Coach Peroni to Texas A&M. You made the NIT in 94, and then you went right back to the Midwest, UW-Milwaukee for a year, and you went back to, for some reason, you went back to Texas A&M under Peroni. I'm not sure what that move was all about. Tell us.
Okay, well, I'll first start, I want to get into coaching. I got done playing for Coach, and I remember clearly is that my dad, to go work for my dad or get into coaching, and, you know, Coach Peroni said, you know, if you want to volunteer and be in the office, you know, and if you want to see if you want to coach. And I remember telling my dad, he's like, how much money are you going to make? I'm like, well, I'm gonna volunteer during the day and bartend at night to make ends meet. And, you know, I did everything, you know, anything Coach would ask for a year. And after that year was over, I went to go work. Coach brought me with him, and I earned some value with him, and he brought me to Texas A&M. And I started back then as the restricted earnings coach. In my first 4 years in the profession, a lot of young coaches don't remember this, but like you were only allowed to make $12,000 a year and $4,000 in camp. So you were restricted on how much you could make. And so I did that for 4 years. And one thing I do with my own staff that I was so thankful for Coach Peroni, that a lot of people get into the profession and people hire them because they can bring a player or they can recruit. And Coach Peroni was so adamant about old school coaches that he came up with that they all started on the high school level, that learned to coach, learned the game, studied the game. And Coach Peroni, those 4 years, he sent me to coaches' clinics, NBA training camps, all off season. And I had to come back and have a report on what I learned at the clinic, what I learned at the training camp. And he was so about, you know, hey, you didn't learn on the high school level, but he made me earn my keep and my thing. So when I went to Milwaukee, that was to go recruit. I got a full-time job. And back then, you only had two full-time assistants. I went with Rick Cobb at Wisconsin-Milwaukee to go get recruiting experience. I was on that thing. We signed four kids, had a number one ranked recruiting class there. And then he hired me back to be a full-time assistant at Texas A&M. And he was, you know, as close as we were, and that's what I always tell my kids, my players, accountability is a sign of love. You know, sometimes the younger generation doesn't, you know, they get mad at accountability. And Coach Peroni, as big a role model as a father figure as well, he held me accountable so much when I was young. That's helped me so much as I'm older. But that's why I went to Milwaukee and then came back.
That's interesting. I mean, it really, really is interesting because, you know, the loyalty, the accountability that these young coaches have today sometimes is not in relationship to the job they want. They just feel like they need success today, or actually yesterday. They want it yesterday. It doesn't happen that way. You got to be accountable and earn your way all along the way. All right. It was at that time, 1998, you kind of separated from Coach Peroni. You went to became part of another great staff with a legendary coach, Wimp Sanderson, another one of my really good friends even today. He was the head coach at that time at Arkansas Little Rock. He offered you the job as an assistant coach there. You went there for two or three years and then became head coach after Coach Peroni, after Coach Sanderson left. Tell us about the experience as being an assistant coach under Wimp Sanderson, who I know very well, and also later as head coach at the University of Arkansas, Little Rock.
I absolutely loved my time with Coach Sanderson. It was too short, but I learned so much of him in a short amount of time. I went to work for him, and then he ended up retiring after that first year. But he is, I mean, if you look, I remember putting together recruiting sheets on his, for his resume, what he did at Alabama. I mean, it was just crazy how much he won there, and I just wanted to learn. And this is another lesson for young coaches. I was going, Coach Broney actually got let go at Texas A&M, and I was out of a job, and I went and had two interviews. I interviewed, ironically, here in Chicago, at Loyola Chicago, as an assistant, and then I interviewed with Coach Wimp Sanderson. I didn't know one person in Little Rock, Arkansas, not one, but I had all my family and friends here, and I went to spend an interview with Coach Sanderson, and after one day, I made the decision on where I thought I'd learn the most, and that comes into play again when I left Illinois State to go work for Coach Majerus, and we'll get to that later. But I just was so he's one of those guys I just wanted to learn from. And, man, was he a good X and O coach. But he also taught me, I'll never forget this, and I say it to all my assistant coaches, and it helps me on how I've been a head coach. I remember him just saying real casually one day, he goes, Porter, I was an assistant coach for 17 years. I'll never forget what it's like to be an assistant coach on how I deal with my own assistant coaches. And that has stuck with me, you know, and how a guy like that with that much success. And then Coach retired, and they gave the job to Sidney Moncrief. And I ended up staying there with Coach Moncrief, and then he got out. I remember him telling me, he's like, I'm going to go with the Dallas Mavericks. And I was like, whoa. And then they promoted me and gave me the job. That's a whole other long story, but I ended up getting the job at 31 years old. We'd won two Division I games the previous year, and we got the job and just wanted to start that thing with energy. I mean, we really relied on Coach Broney on talking about building a program, and we won 18 games or more my 3 years there. And but that's how I got my break. I was an assistant coach. I wasn't thinking about being the head coach. I wasn't behind the scenes maneuvering to be a head coach. I was just trying to do my job as best as I can, and apparently, along the way, I impressed people around the university and how I handled myself and how hard I worked, and I was able to get the job.
And then Illinois State came along, offered you a job there. There was a program that was really struggling at the time that you took over, and you know things didn't go as easy there as you would have liked, or as well there as you would have liked. How did you deal with that?
So I remember. I really enjoyed Little Rock. We had a great team coming back. We had just won 18 games and had pretty much the whole team coming back. And they offered me a long-term deal, but it was the state school of where I grew up. It was the conference that I played in. It was 2 hours from home, and my father had passed, and my mom was battling some illness. And I'm like, you know what? It's the state school, and I went there. But they, too, were in last place. And everybody has obstacles. You know, everybody has obstacles. We had that 8-5 rule that a lot of young coaches don't remember, and we were strapped with scholarships. But we started turning it, and, you know, just what a lot of coaches always told me is you try not to do it quick. You know, do it the right way, and we felt we were doing it the right way. I signed a 7-year deal, but I got bought out after my fourth year. I had everybody coming back. I had we had won 17 games, and I had my starting five back. And we really thought we were going to turn the corner, but the business stepped in. I had my third athletic director in 3 years or 4 years, and it happened. And I'll be honest with you, and this is why I call most coaches that get fired that I know. And it was a dark place for me. It was a very, very dark place losing your job in your mid to late 30s with four kids and in that profession. And it was tough, but unequivocally, it was another defining moment for me. I look back on it now with my faith. With that whole situation was the biggest blessing in my life, professionally. And that is something that I've carried on. I thought about my times at Creighton. Do I quit? Do I get out of coaching? You know, this is a tough profession, all that. And I went through all those thoughts, Coach. And I finally came to the thing, like, you know, this is what I want to do. And that led me to my next move to go with Coach Majerus.
All right, now, you know, that's a great story. It's a great learning time in your life. And, you know, I could sit here and just say, what'd you learn from that? But it's clear that it was, you know, keep on keeping on and don't let the game itself beat you down. You just attacked it and you were fortunate in the year 2007. You received a phone call from Rick Majerus, and I'm pretty sure that Tony Barone had something to do with that because they were great friends. And I was a great friend with Rick Majerus as well because, you know, we used to play each other all the time when he was at Utah and all. But, you know, talk about a great coach, a guy who had a great feel for the game itself. He offered you a job. You took the job at St. Louis University. 4 years there with him, long practices, long film sessions, long rides in planes, long meals, a lot of meals, Italian meals. What was it like coaching with Rick Majerus, one of the real colorful characters in our game?
It was just such a blessing. But I will say to that moment and of deciding what to do, and this is another lesson for young coaches or anything, but I referenced why I took the Little Rock job, and I've just been a big foundation. I know another one of your friends, Kevin Eastman, always talks about being a lifelong learner. Is I had an opportunity to become a head D1 coach after I got fired at a low Division I school. And the temptation, the ego part of myself, was so tempted to take that. And I remember going to the Kingwood Classic, and I don't know if you remember this, Coach, and it just speaks to you as well, that I remember sitting there in the stands, and I had a conversation with you. And you were like, you called over another high-level Division I head coach, and you said, hey, you got to talk to Porter. And I started thinking about learning as an assistant coach again. And I had a conversation with another guy right there. I left Kingwood Classic. I landed on a plane in Chicago. I'm driving back to St. Louis, and Rick Majerus calls me. Now, I haven't seen Rick Majerus. I've met him one time in my life, and that was in the Maui Classic when I was the restricted earnings coach. And back then, you had the VCR tapes, and his restricted earnings said, let's exchange tapes. And we had the late game, and I had to dub it. And back then, you had to wait for the 2 hours of the game film to dub. And so I go, I'll meet you at the pool at 2 o'clock. And I walk down at the pool, and Rick Majerus was in his flip-flop and Utah shirt. And I'm like 25 years old, and we exchange tapes, and he goes, so what did you think of when they did the ball screen to the right 5 times? I'm like, holy cow, I don't know. I mean, he was asking me a million questions. Never spoke to him again until when he called me inquiring about coming to work for him. And I just said to myself, I talked to my wife, I said, I could go back to be a head coach, but that's going to be a rough road. I go, to learn from one of the greatest minds in basketball, I made that decision based on how much I was going to learn. It was a lot less money. It was I was going to St. Louis blind, you know, not a lot of people there I knew. And right away, he had a different mind. The way he would look at the game, the way we'd sit in film and talk about stopping the opponent, the way he would do things, his skill development, like you say, long practices, it's the attention to detail that I've never seen anything like it, the attention to detail with him. It was an unbelievable experience. He was so good to my family and I. And in those 4 years, I learned so much that's affected me. And I look back on that decision. And that's why I look back on that whole failure at Illinois State. And I don't want to say failure. I want to say more of a setback. And that it was a blessing. It was a blessing to go have my time there. And that led me to Loyola. And I learned so much about myself, the game. You know, you referenced these long meals. That was one of the harder parts of working for him back then, is I had 4 young kids, and he'd be like, Coach Porter, let's go grab a quick bite. And I'm like, there's no such thing as a quick bite with Coach. It's an event. And we'd go to dinner for like 3-4 hours. And I would give my right arm to have a dinner with Coach Majerus right now. And I said this during the Final Four run. I know he was looking down, and I really thought he would have loved watching our team play and how we played, because it had his footprint and his handprint all over it.
All right, look, we're winding down here now. This is fascinating. I could go on for another hour. I'm going to hit you with some quick things and give me a short answer on each one as we head down the home stretch. We hadn't talked about Loyola. We hadn't talked about the Final Four. What did the Final Four run mean to your university?
It's hard to even put into words. I mean, the enrollments changed, the mentalities changed, but like, I think the pride factor, you know, the amount of people that, you know, we were having like a couple hundred people come to games. We had 8 sellouts last year. You know, we had alumni all over the country coming, you know, now are proud of their Loyola, you know, the sports. We've changed the mindset of the alumni, changed the mindset of people, how they look at Loyola. I remember people in the Missouri Valley didn't want us to come in. We were replacing Creighton. Now we've won it back to back. And it's just, it's a mindset. It's a pride. The facilities here now are going through the roof. What they're doing here, personally, it was you know, my faith of God having a plan of doing it the right way with, you know, it's just solidified how we built a program with high character, right kids, winning programs, the academics, and it meant the world to me. And it's also a great thing, and I'm really vocal about it, talking to young coaches about it, that, you know, you don't have to let setbacks define you in your life. You know, I'm the poster child for having a setback in my career. Got fired as an assistant when I was with Coach Barone. Got fired as a head coach at Illinois State. And just keep doing your job. Keep going to places where you're going to learn. Be a lifelong learner. And have high character along the way. And I've been blessed with having people in my life to do that. And that's what the Loyola thing really meant to me.
This podcast would not be complete unless we mention Sister Jean. I mean, is she still there? Is she still around? Is she still part of your program? How do you keep her uplifted?
She turned 100 in August, and the guarantees that you're going to get that in life that I know is she's going to be at every one of her home games. An hour after the game, I'm going to get an email every home game. And then before every game, she's going to pray for us and pray for the eyesight of the officials. Those are guarantees with Sister Jean. She's still around. She's doing great. She's our chaplain. And she turned 100 in August.
Wow. Amazing. We've seen several changes in the NCAA tournament selection process. You know, they've gone to more analytics. There's some other things that come into play right now. NET instead of the RPI. You know, they're just things. What do you think of these changes? Do you think they've been beneficial for mid-major schools like yourself, or does it make it harder to reach the round of 68, if you will?
Well, I'd love to do a long podcast with you because there's no short answer to that. But to be honest, no, it doesn't help mid-majors. It doesn't help that because we can't get the schedule. It's all based on quad 1, 2, 3, and 4, getting those wins. The numbers show you what of the winning percentages of quad 1 and 2s of home rather than road. You know, when you're at home, you have the winning percentages are high. It's so hard for me to get a schedule, and I'm not trying to play like poor me. I get it. Some of my closest friends in the profession are at that level. And now that most of these conferences are going to 20 games, then they're playing interconference challenges. Then they have these MTEs. They have 4 games left to schedule. And they say either we want a guaranteed win or we want to play another Power 5 school, and you're neither. And I get it. So I'm not blaming the other coaches for not playing. I'm not. It's very, very hard to get a resume to get into that 68 when you're not in one of those Power 5 conferences because they have so many teams that you can get that resume from. I get it. I have a couple of solutions, but it'll be another long podcast.
We'll have to come back to you for that. But, you know, you're looking like right now, we're just in the first quarter of the college basketball season. And, you know, there are people that are saying the Big Ten is the best conference in the country right now. I think it probably is. There's some really great teams in there. But they're also saying there might be as many as 10 or 11 teams that qualify for the NCAA tournament out of that conference. I don't think that's true. I think because as they get into the conference play, they'll start beating each other up. But, you know, they can be too many teams coming out of one league like that. And I think it just kind of warps what we're looking at come tournament time. The style of play in college basketball has changed. We're looking at games now, both teams playing with 4 and sometimes 5 guys outside of 3. Are you a big advocate of that, or are you just falling in line with it because that's the cute thing to do? It's an in-favor type thing to do. What's your feeling on that? Will the big man ever come back in college basketball?
Well, my feeling is I've been playing just because it's hard to get five or six high level 6'8", 6'9" plus guys at our level. I know a lot of people, so I've been playing four out, one in, you know, with four guards, one big for a while. And then we've got that old school Cameron Krutwig. If you remember him in the Final Four run, he was a freshman, started for me as a freshman. And I love having a traditional big man. Now, I'm lucky because he can pass, he's crafty, but we've recruited to that. And we've been trying to recruit to, you know, four guys, at least four guys on the floor that can shoot it. You know, I think with that 3-point line, if you can, you know, you start getting two, three guys on the floor that can't shoot, I think teams are, the coaches are so well, you know, scouting nowadays and defensive minded that you start getting two, three guys that can't shoot, I think it changes the game. For us, that's been a philosophy now that we've recruited to. And if you saw our Final Four run, we were really trying to space it with four guards and then had our true traditional big man in there. And I love playing that way, and that's why I'm going to continue to recruit.
Last question for you, Porter. If you were in charge of college basketball, what's the one change you would like to make it better?
You know, this goes back to the scheduling. I just think that if there's so many things about rankings of like conferences and this. I thought this. If you take, let's say at the end of the year, the top 11 conferences in the country, if you win your conference, an 18 or 20 game conference race, I think you should get an automatic bid. Now, let me tell you how that plays out. It's really going to only affect two or three teams because the Power Five and some of the top seven or eight, if you win your league, you've already got the resume to be in it. But what's going to affect is some of the other leagues. For instance, and I'm not just saying that for us, we won the conference back-to-back last year. It was very hard to repeat. We had some injuries, and we came back. We stumbled to a very good Bradley team in the tournament by two, I think. And I don't want it to come down. I think the whole country would have loved to seen a Loyola back in, won the conference championship, opposed to a team that finished ninth in their league and was, you know, 8-12. And I think if that extra bid to the top 11 conferences, it only affect two or three conferences that team might have been on the bubble. And I think the NCAA tournament, I think that'd be great for the NCAA tournament. You get those teams that earned it. The meat of the season had value, and to whether a kid has an ankle or a kid, something that happens in the conference tournament, that everything doesn't go down to that on some of these other teams. So that was a short version of what I just think, because the NCAA tournament is just so incredibly exciting.
Interesting, really interesting. I wish we had more time. I want to thank everyone for tuning in to the NABC Guardians of the Game podcast and to Coach Porter Moser. Porter, you're a champion, man. You're a champ. I don't care where you
met. I appreciate your mentorship over the years, too, and the person you are for our profession. You've been an advocate for our profession for many, many years and someone that all of us young coaches in my generation looked up to.
Well, thank you very much and giving us some time and listening to your thoughts, and you had so much really valuable information. So good luck to your team the rest of the season, and to those that are interested in learning more about the podcast, visit nabc.com.